Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. I'm reminded the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering its full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank, so it belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. For more information, www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner on our webpage. Let me say this to you again, as I said earlier. This is one of our Urbanite radio stories. Every month we take several articles out of the Urbanite magazine, working with them, turn them into conversations or documentaries or visits to the places they're talking about. And one of the lead articles this month was about Plan Maryland, and it's called The Era of Sprawl. Let me get this right for you all. The era of suburban sprawl has to end. So now what? Is the name of the article by McKay Jenkins, a pretty thorough article. And it raises many issues. And I said earlier as we went into this, one of the issues that it raises is that, as I said, it took three centuries to develop 650,000 acres here in the state of Maryland. Over the next million acres have been done over the last 40 years since 1970 at a rate that's three times as fast as the growth of our state population. 873 acres of farmland and 500,000 acres of forest were turned into developments and other things like that. And we do have one of the longest commutes in the country. And as I posited before we started this conversation, is it just the nature of things, the way we are in America? This is who we are, what we've become, what we're going to become, and there's no turning back. We have to figure out a way to live with it. Or is there something out of whack? And we know what you think. And many people listening to this show, whether you're listening to us from outside the city, if you're listening to us in Baltimore County or Howard County or Prince George's County or Montgomery County or Anne Arundel County, or even over there near Chestertown, you may live in one of those new developments with your sprawling houses and the world that we all, that many people live in. And you can join us here at 410-319-8888 and talk about that and why you live there and what life is like and your thoughts about this whole issue. So we want to welcome our guests. We have Richard Hall here, who is the Secretary of Planning for the state of Maryland. Richard, good to see you once again.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be here.
Leslie Knapp is with us, and Leslie is the Maryland Association of Counties Associate Director. Leslie, welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be here.
And Gerald Weingrad is with us. He served in the Maryland House of Delegates and the State Senate for over 16 years, and is at the, now at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy as a professor where he teaches. And, Jerry, good to have you in the studio once again.
Thanks.
So, I mean, those stats are what they are, and we'll go through some of the others and what they mean. And I guess, you know, the bottom line – every time you turn around, there's development growing somewhere in the counties, in the suburbs, out in the farmlands. You see it wherever you drive. I'm just curious what the three of you think. I mean, is this the state of affairs? Is this, you know, when you remember in the late 40s when Pete Seeger wrote the song Little Houses, Little Ticky-Tacky Houses that lived out and everybody moved out to, that our fathers did when they came home from World War II? Well, that was then, but this is now. And development is happening everywhere. Is this the way of life in America? Is it something we have to adapt to? Is it something that we have to figure a way around? Because clearly it's here. So let's start with the Secretary.
Sure. Well, thank you. Well, first thing I think it's important to establish is that everyone has to live somewhere. And we haven't seen a whole lot of growth lately in Maryland or across the country, and that's been an international financial issue that we're all familiar with. But Maryland still continues to see development pressures, and we will going forward. We're still projected to grow by a million new Marylanders in the next 25 years. And, you know, they can – a lot of them can live in Baltimore City, for example, which has lost population since its peak in the 1950s. Baltimore City had a population of almost a million people in 1950, and now the population of Baltimore City is around 620,000. So that's around a third of the city's population. I'm not suggesting that all new growth will go and fill in Baltimore City back to its historic levels of the 1950s. But I think that I use that as an illustration to suggest that there's a lot of ways we can grow smart. We can try to repopulate some of the areas that have been abandoned or have slowed down the population. Even our older suburbs are seeing some of the same trends as well to a lesser of a degree. And also grow more smartly not only where but how we grow, with mixed use, more tight development as opposed to the spread out development that consumes many, many more times lands per household than a smart growth pattern. So those things are really key on a site-by-site basis, but they really matter over time and over large numbers, like a million new Marylanders coming in over time. And that's essential for a state like Maryland, where we care about our bay, our local rivers and streams, and our small and large communities across the state.
Leslie Knapp, let me turn to you next, and we'll go to Jerry Weingrad.
Well, I think it's very clear that there has been growth in Maryland. Maryland has been, because of its many blessings, a high-growth state, and growth is going to continue to occur. Maryland is actually one of the more densely populated states in the nation, and we do need to get a handle on and a fix on how we grow looking to the future. We have been considered a smart growth leader in the past. We continue to adopt and test new practices. I think many of those are positive, but I do want to put in one cautionary note, is that Maryland is a very diverse state. We've often been called American miniature. We have very different demographic and geographic counties, municipalities, and areas in our state, and that's a strength, candidly. However, that does make tackling sophisticated, complex issues like growth challenging, because a one-size-fits-all does not work, and I think most of Maryland's current smart growth efforts work fairly well in urban areas and urban counties. They have not been as successful or worked as well in rural jurisdictions.
Jerry Weingrad.
The issue of growth and development and sprawl threatens to undermine our economy, our state revenue structure, our quality of life, and it definitely is contributing significantly to the destruction of the Chesapeake Bay and our rivers and our fishing industry, as well as recreational and commercial. The destruction does not have to happen, but it's because of an upside-down system that we have, where over centuries the development decisions are left in the hands of local government, where much of the funding that funds the sprawl and the poor development decisions of local government is left in the hands of the state. For instance, constructing new schools, building new highways, paying a good chunk of the cost for courts and jails and police stations and libraries, and you could go on. And so that failure to address these is leaving us with a greatly decreased productivity in the Chesapeake Bay, a greatly decreased quality of life, and a failing system of infrastructure, where we have to build more and more new sewer lines, water supply lines, more schools, more firehouses, while we close them in Baltimore City and some urban areas. Baltimore City is having its life's blood sucked out of them by poor decisions in the counties that welcome any and all development. Even if a corporate 500 company wanted to relocate today in Baltimore City and downtown, they'd be snapped up with all kinds of tax credits, incentives in any of the surrounding counties or ones even further out. Baltimore City in 1950 had 949,000 and some people. Right now, Baltimore City is down to about 620,000. It's lost 35% of its population. We're closing fire stations, libraries, rec centers, schools in Baltimore City, and firehouses, while we have to build ones in the surrounding counties, while the counties and municipalities say, just leave us alone, send us the money from Annapolis, and let us develop as we see fit, because each county is different.
Well, let me ask the question. I mean, do you think, let me just put some things on the table here. Folks, we do want you to join us, 410-319-8888. I really know, where do you live and how do you live? And do you live in one of these new developments? Do you live in part of the suburban world? Do you live in the city? What are your thoughts on how you live and how you got there? What you think the future is going to be for you and your children? 410-319-8888. And should there be some controls put on development? That's one of the questions we're going to tackle today. 410-319-8888 is the number here. I mean, so one of the issues put in this article in the Urbanite magazine, and one of the quotes said, actually, this turns out to be a Jerry Weingrad quote. So let's take this quote and throw it out and see what we think, all right? Jerry Weingrad in the article said, local governments make all the land use decisions, and they haven't cared about sprawl so long as it maximizes their tax coffers. It was a quote from Jerry Weingrad in this article. So should these development decisions about where things are developed be made by localities, counties, city, small municipalities, mixture of two, or the state. Let's just start there. We'll talk about the influences on all those things in a minute. But let's just talk about who should make these decisions and why. Gentlemen, you want to jump off first, Leslie?
I'll certainly jump in. I would have to disagree with Senator Weingrad's assertion that counties, local governments only care about their bottom line. Certainly in the past, going back into the 50s, there wasn't the focus on long-term, smart, good planning that there is today. But for the most part, counties do take planning and land use decisions very seriously. And there's several reasons why it should stay at the local level. First off, local officials know the needs of their citizens best. They have everyday contact with their citizens and understand their needs and preferences. If people of a county or a municipality do not like the choices an elected official makes while in office, then those people will hold that official accountable during the next election. And the two quickest ways to get voted out of office at the local level is to go against your citizens' expectation regarding taxes and land use. You do not get that same level of understanding or accountability from an unelected state official. Counties have several – they have been lauded in several ways for their planning. First, county comprehensive plans do form the basis for growth and planning in the state, and they guide local zoning. They're adopted through a very public and open process and must be approved by the local legislative body. So there is citizen input there. Two, agricultural preservation. We talk about the loss of farmland, and because Maryland has been a high-growth state, that's been a critical issue. But counties are committed to agricultural preservation, and most have very strong agricultural preservation programs. When ranking the top 10 county preservation programs in the entire nation, four of those top 10 slots are Maryland counties. And in fact, Maryland has preserved more farmland than any other state in the nation.
Jerry.
Well, this is the same old malarkey that the counties and municipalities, their attitude is just let us alone, let us do all the land use planning and send the checks from Annapolis to support this. If the counties and municipalities have done or doing such a good job, how come we've lost so much population in Baltimore City? And what's striking, people will say, oh, it's the crime. You know, it's white flight. It's the schools. You know, when you look at the demographic data, of the Maryland's 157 towns and cities under the census, 48 of those lost population since the last census from 2000 to 2010, and 53 of those municipalities gained less than 100 people, while Maryland's population grew by 9%. So it isn't just Baltimore City. It's because of these poor policies. Smart growth doesn't work. There's been more development of land outside of the smart growth priority funding areas and smart growth are just about equal to what happened 10 years before that. Plan Maryland is a farce. It really doesn't change the paradigm at all. Senator Ron Young, a former Deputy Secretary of State Planning, mayor of Frederick City, said on the floor of the Senate, well, I don't know what all the hubris is about. Plan Maryland does nothing. It's a nothing burger. And so the real answer is, if the counties and municipalities were doing such a good job, why have we lost hundreds of thousands of acres of farmland, hundreds of thousand acres of forest land? Why, since 1973 to 2010, did we grow by 39% while developed land increased by 154%? The answer is that the counties and municipalities have failed miserably to adequately plan and adequately focus development in the areas that it should be focused on, and that includes under smart growth. My final comment is the basic provisions of our state comprehensive planning under smart growth, Plan Maryland, or anything, and it has been for more than 40 years, is that the counties are required by state law to at least develop comprehensive development plans and update them every 6 years, and they're supposed to incorporate smart growth principles in. Dr. Rebecca Lewis of the University of Maryland Smart Growth Center, who got her PhD studying smart growth and said that it was a failure in her study. It's published. It's been in journals with some of her professors. She said that in the counties that the counties and municipalities, many of them had failed to even update their plan. She found that more than half of all Maryland municipalities did not update their comprehensive plans to incorporate these principles under the state law, and five counties had not even updated their comprehensive plans going through the political process, et cetera. And finally, three of the counties that had updated didn't even mention smart growth. They didn't mention priority funding areas even in their general development plans. So I don't know what state planning has done to enforce that. For God's sake, the only thing they can do probably is withhold money, and nobody in Maryland has had a significant amount of courage to start whacking the counties for violating state law.
So before we get to the phones here and some other questions on race and what you guys have said, let me turn to Secretary Hall.
Well, I'm having a good time just sitting back here and watching Les and Jerry go back and forth. But a couple points. One, there always is a natural tension between state and local governments on growth issues, and that's not unique to Maryland, but probably it's more the case in Maryland. And I think it is mostly a healthy tension, and sometimes it gets a little more than that. But, you know, there is, I think, a clear state role in planning, and I think it's a shared responsibility. And I know we talk about this a lot, again, the state's role versus the local government's role, and it's important to know that, again, nationally, not just in Maryland, but it's the state governments enable local governments to have the planning and zoning authority that they have. And we work with them on that. You know, going back to Les's point about accountability, I understand the point, you know, government closest to the people and that type of thing. But I don't think it's fair to characterize us as not being accountable at the state level. Certainly, you know, Maryland is not the biggest state in the country, and I think to characterize us as being, you know, not engaged in what's going on at a local level, it's not completely fair. We do, you know, a lot of outreach to local governments, work with them. Certainly, again, we are not on the ground at the local level, acknowledge that, but everyone has their key role. On the Plan Maryland part, you know, Jerry's point about Plan Maryland, the governor signed an executive order finalizing Plan Maryland in December, so that's 4 months ago. So I would ask that he gives us a chance. Plan Maryland is a policy document, and that's what it's meant to be. That's what it's designed to be. It's a strategy for smart growth in Maryland. As many smart growth programs that we've had for decades in this state, we've never had one game plan, one strategy to pull it together, and that's what the plan is. And one of the things I think will help back that up on the sort of rural sprawl side to a large degree and helping to protect the Bay, River, and Streams is the recently passed septic bill that we may talk about more in a minute. So I could say an awful lot about the studies that Jerry referred to. Again, for the most part, a lot of the information came from my agency, and we've been tracking those growth trends for a very long time. And we have seen a lot of growth occur outside of the smart growth areas across the state. And I think one of the things that's hard to say is how much worse would it be if we did not have the smart growth programs in place we have at the state and the local levels.
So there's some questions I want to raise about all the things you just said. But let me go to the phones first. Get a couple of callers in here, their thoughts. Then I'm going to come back to Plan Maryland and harken back to the days when I interviewed Parrish Glendening numerous times, especially in his first administration, after he got reelected, didn't want to come back too much, but during his first 4 years when we talked about smart growth. But let's go to the phones at 410-319-8888. TC in Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Yes, Mark. I'd like to know when the city of Tomas can actually do development.
Say it again.
The city.
Say that one more time. I'm sorry.
I'd like to know when they're actually do. I live in the city. I live in Brooklyn, which is like the most southern part of the city, short of Curtis Bay.
Uh-huh.
I'm just wondering if they're going to do any kind of growth or anything down here. Because, honestly, in the city especially, any growth or building that they do is other parts of the city. I mean, Federal Hill has got everything. And yet, Brooklyn is like the forgotten neighborhood.
I don't know if I can speak to what's happening in Brooklyn here on this particular panel. I know that there's a lot of controversy right now because people worry that Brooklyn is going to be completely gentrified and folks who live there kind of gone, and there is planned development that way, but I don't know much more than that at the moment.
Well, this is Rich. I'm familiar with where Brooklyn is and that part of the city, and I think you know, it's experienced some of the growth issues or lack of growth issues that a lot of our older developed areas have. I can't speak to any specific active projects there right now, but I think what you're seeing there is sort of the need for reinvestment, revitalization that we see in a number of parts of the state.
I mean, what does happen in places like Brooklyn? I mean, and we'll do this show about this another day. But what happens in places like Brooklyn a lot, you know, any places on the water, is developers do salivate over water. And many times it's poor people and a lot of working class people who live by the water for a long time and are being pushed out of the water so they can build condos and other things at, say, a higher tax brackets. I have a friend who lives in Dundalk, has lived in the same house on the water for the last 75 years in his family, and they're trying to push him out, but he refuses to leave because clearly they want to build something up for people of higher income to move into. And his line is, I don't care what your income is, this is my house, I'm not going anywhere. So that is an issue, but we'll come to that issue another day. TC, that's a really good stuff, and I appreciate the call. 410-319-8888. Travis, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm a current city resident. I'm a renter. I'm looking to buy, but what I'm finding when I look to buy in the city, and this does relate to development, is that the majority of the new housing and the improved housing is for a tax bracket, for people who don't exist in Baltimore City. You see places like Harbor East and, you know, some new stuff over by the Visionary Museum. Those condos are, you know, multi-million dollar condos. All the new development in the city and a lot of the new development in the suburbs is a sort of high-end, high-line, condo-centric development. But you don't see development for people like me. I work for a living. You know, I make, you know, way under 100 grand a year. And I'd like to own a house too, but unfortunately my mayor and my city and frankly my state seem more interested in kind of pushing all the money and all the development focus on the Highline development. And then of course they build retail next door. The people who work in Harbor East don't live in Harbor East because they could never afford to. And I think that if we had a focus that was more on development, you know, mixed use development and development, you know, to, if you want to encourage jobs, which will of course encourage growth, you would want to have development of properties, you know, where people who work in their surrounding businesses could actually afford to live in their neighborhood as well.
I mean, this is a really important point. And I'd like you all to jump in on this for a minute, just because I think this is where you talk about the kinds of developments we have, whether in the city or elsewhere, but they're not in anybody's control except folks who want to build and develop and make money in the development. So people like Travis are pushed out of the ability to buy a home or even move into a place.
Well, one of the things that's obvious with the very poor policies in the county surrounding Baltimore City, all the way up even into Harford County, where people live and work in the city. I have relatives generations back that grew up in Baltimore City that now commute from Harford County that have moved out. So until we reverse that trend of Baltimore City losing population because of making it easy to move out and live out in the burbs and consume more land and pollute more, we need to reorient that because there are enough vacant houses in Baltimore City probably to house conservatively 150,000 more people easily without – and you could turn those into very, very livable and nice places to live without the greater investment that it takes to build the same units just 10, 20, 30, 40, and 50 miles away. So you need a reurbanization policy with the cooperation of the surrounding counties and municipalities, not a robber baron mentality that now exists of take all and any development and even subsidize it with tax credits, all kind of gimmies, training, things to bring in corporations as well as residential development in the surrounding counties.
I could just make a couple points, if I may. This is Rich. And Travis, there are a number of options, older developments as well as new across the city. They may not make some of the headlines like some of the higher-end ones that you mentioned, but, you know, the building more apartments downtown. Downtown was one of the fastest-growing parts of Baltimore City in the last 10 years, and that came out very clearly in the census. Actually, it was the fastest growing in terms of residential growth. Downtown was in Baltimore. But there's a number of projects that have occurred in the last several years and some active now in the city that may be attractive. I just will throw out one nonprofit that could be helpful to you looking for a place. It's called Live Baltimore. You can look them up online, and they may be helpful for you finding a place to live in the city. And I think it is very important. I completely agree with you. People need to live where they work as much as possible. And as you may know, our mayor here in Baltimore City has a goal of 10,000 new families coming back to the city to sort of build on Jerry's point. So it's going to be slow going, and the population loss in the city has slowed down, but it's still lost population in the last 10 years. It's going to be slow going to repopulate the city. I'm an optimist. You have to be an optimist to be a planner, I think. and I think that we're going to slowly repopulate the city.
So if you want to pick up a quick point, Leslie, and then move on to another issue.
I just put in affordable housing is certainly a challenge. One of the issues is that for redeveloping where you're building and modifying existing infrastructure, that tends to be more expensive than actually just building from the ground up because you have a lot of environmental and administrative and regulatory requirements that are in place that you now have to meet. So that does add to the underlying cost for doing a lot of these redevelopments.
So let me ask this question. When we talk about – let me start from localities and build out. I want to come to Plan Maryland, what can be done, if anything can change or not, in a second. But let's take the idea here that we're supposed to move back – remain that the localities are supposed to control these decisions. Most counties, let's say in Baltimore County, it's the county councilman who decides what gets rezoned and what doesn't, what gets to be developed and what doesn't get to be developed. And all the other councilmen go along with him or her to make that happen. That's like almost in every county I know, that's how it works. In the city, it's the same way. You respect the council person and their district to make the decision. So that, to me, is how the planning process really works. You have these planning boards that recommend things, but really what it comes down to is what this councilman's going to do. And if – and I don't mean to sound pejorative of this, but I don't know how else to put it. Because I'm trying to think of a way to sound – it doesn't sound that way. But as I've said over the years, developers – are in some way like the old defense contractors in Capitol Hill. They're the power brokers in a state. They have a lot of power in any state they're in. And counties really want revenue because they want property taxes. You get property taxes when you build houses. So when you have a situation, let's say, like in Baltimore County right now, where you have a councilman like Todd Huff, who represents the district where most of the rural area is in Baltimore County. Well, he's leading the charge to rezone a lot of those properties for development. And even though people are opposing him, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people came out to oppose this, and the planning board still went along with rezoning these properties that were farms, were woods, and now, in the next 5 years, will be houses. So when you have that, and you have sometimes like a revolving door, and I don't want to cast aspersions, but like the man who runs it in Baltimore County spent the last 7 years of his life representing developers in his law firm, Mr. Jablon, and now he's the man who's running the environmental issues and development for the county. Is something right or wrong with that picture? I mean, so I want to come back to what that means and see what you all think. And I was trying to put it in a more objective sense, but I didn't know how to put it out there, just to lay it out there. I had to lay it out as I've seen it. We're going to take a very brief break and come back and wrestle with that question and more. Join us here at 410-319-8888. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner reminding you that WEAA invites you to the opening reception of the Sam Wallace Jamaican Folk Art, Pottery, and Modern Technique this Saturday, April 28th from 4 to 6 p.m. at our WEAA studios. There'll be a gallery talk at 5 p.m. Beverly Carter and Lewis Hudnell are the curators. The exhibition runs to the end of May. For more information, 443-885-3564 or WEAA.org. Sponsored in part by DMV REI United. And let me just say, I know Sam Wallace and his work. It's incredible. You don't want to miss this exhibit. The man is amazing. Anyhow, back to our stuff here with Richard Hill, Secretary of Planning for the State of Maryland, Leslie Knapp, Maryland Association of Counties, MACO as it's called, Associate Director, Jerry Weingrad, now a University of Maryland School of Public Policy professor, but served for 16 years in the Maryland House of Delegates and the State Senate. Our number is 410-319-8888. So where I left off. I mean, that what I described in Baltimore County is not uncommon in counties across the state of Maryland. So, and we say, as you just said earlier, let's just start with, but I mean, we know, as you said earlier, you said you can vote people out, but you can't, because the way the system works, it just is not easy to unseat an incumbent. no matter where they are, because people don't care about voting anymore. They don't come out in droves to vote. Things happen. They feel powerless to kind of control the situation, despite the hundreds I saw at senior high school in Baltimore County who were saying, no, 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 stop, stop, stop. But nobody was listening to them at all. Leslie?
I would actually disagree with that assessment when applied to the local level. I think their citizens are more actively engaged because many of the decisions they view that a local elected official makes, they can see more of a direct linkage or impact to them. Could be something as simple as, did that elected official move to fix the potholes that are outside on my street? And it's not uncommon in an election cycle for us to have a 50% or slightly higher turnover rate of our local elected officials. I don't believe that is anywhere near the stability that you have at a federal level or even at the state. But that's not not uncommon, at least for Maryland counties.
But if – go ahead. Who wants to jump in? Jerry and then Rich.
The answer to your question that you correctly perceived, the system is corrupted. I'm not saying that there's criminality. It is corrupted. It's corroded and corrupted because – so many members of county councils and county commissions, so many county executives, so many legislators have direct interest in seeing real estate developed and making money off of it. Either they're in real estate directly as speculators or landowners. I don't just mean their own home. Either they're real estate agents themselves. They're farmers who don't want any interference. They just want money from the federal and state government. They don't want anyone to interfere with their God-given right to put 60 condos on a cow pasture or on a cornfield. And you have the counties and municipalities that absolutely want no state intrusion into their God-given right to do whatever they want with planning and zoning. And what I would say is until that corrupted system is radically changed, we're going to continue to suffer not just quality of life and traffic jams and air quality problems and health problems, but also in the suffering of the Chesapeake Bay, the destruction of our water courses and our river systems, and in the pocketbook. Sprawl cost an enormous amount of money. Rich Hall's group at State Planning did a wonderful job in the part of state planning that lays out the case for a stronger state land use presence because of all the documentation of the incredible amount of destruction of lands. And I just say, if the counties, municipalities are doing such a good job and the system works as we're humming along, why did we lose such an incredible amount of acreage in farmland? We lost 600,000 acres of farmland since 1973 to 2010 and 400,000 acres of forest land. If we're doing such a good job, why do we lose 1 million acres of forest and ag land if the counties are doing with sprawl, which was unnecessary to lose so much acreage? And so I've been part of the system. I've been a representative of a county, Anne Arundel County, part of it. I've been a representative of a municipality. Annapolis was included in it. And I can tell you that so many folks have direct interest. It's in their pocketbook. You know, it's in their interest. They think that the state and the counties have a duty to see that real estate values increase so that everybody can make more money. I've talked to county officials that told me that.
I just make a couple points. I mean, clearly, where people live, how they live and property values and who can do what with their land is extremely sensitive and yes, can be a political issue. And that's the case nationally. It's land rights and development rights and that type of thing are tough. They're tough public policy issues, and they do get political, no doubt about it. One thing I will say, and we have a long way to go at state and local level in many cases, and we have a lot of successes. I don't want us to gloss over that. But a couple of things I'll say that help make things better is that, you know, we do have a sophisticated planning processes, certainly at the local level, and it's getting better at the state level. And given all the challenges that are out there and all the pressures, local, regionally, state level pressures on where to grow, where not to grow, I think Maryland's strong history with planning at the state and local level helps make that situation a lot better than it would be.
Let me ask this, Rich. I mean, how does it do that? I mean, how does it help small communities in the Sparks or Moncton or in Southern Oral County or in Howard County outside of Clarksville who want to maintain land? How does it help them? Because I don't see how it does that.
Well, I think that, you know, things certainly happen, but I would submit to you that more than most other states, local governments have plans that, yes, things happen, but they – many more times than not follow those plans. They give people some semblance of predictability of where growth will occur and where it can't. Do difficult projects pop up from time to time? Absolutely. But I would submit to you that more times than not, local plans are generally followed. Could they be followed more tightly in some cases? Yes. Could it be more aggressive in some implementation of some parts of the plans? Yes. But I would submit to you that our process works better in Maryland than it does in most other parts of this country.
Let me go to the phone, see if we'll come back to our guests at 410-319-8888. And Faye, in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, gentlemen. I just have one comment. This is something that I fear is actually global. And it's not just about Maryland or even the United States. It's becoming a problem when people don't think about the environment. They don't think about growing food. They don't think about anything except for money, you know. They heard the gentleman say that they're, that people can go and vote. But voter turnout, as you stated, Mark, is low, especially in the midst. And Maryland, to me, when I was the poll, it seems very strange to me, you know, that they could say that you could vote someone out when the incumbents always win, it seems, here. And on top of that, me and my daughter looked at the Globe 20 years ago from the Hubble Space, whatever that thing is. She showed it to me. And 20 years ago, the Earth was a lot more green. Right now, we look at it, and it's a lot more brown. What are we really trying to accomplish? All of this money that people are trying to make, what is it really going to do for us if we can't survive it?
Faye, it's a good question. And I think that gets throughout here. I mean, I want all three of you to kind of wrestle with something that Faye was just alluding to, is what do you do? I mean, how do you – should we be controlling development, and what does that mean, and how do you do it? I mean, it's you know, I mean, if farmland is being gobbled up across the state of Maryland all the time, so how do you really address this, and can it be addressed?
Well, let me try to answer the question from an urban dwelling position. Baltimore City has one of the highest cancer rates, lung cancer rates in the country for black males of anywhere in the United States of America. And there's a high cancer rate of urban dwellers in Baltimore City overall. And that's partially because of the high pollution that we have. People don't realize that all of the data that we're spewing out here and some of the data you gave at the start about the longest commute times has a very severe effect, not just on the people in the cars, but the people breathing the exhaust that are coming out of those tailpipes. So we have code reds, code oranges. We have to get vehicle inspections because of the tremendous amount of air pollution caused by sprawl. So when Harford County makes a decision, or the city of Annapolis or another county, that allows for more sprawl and more destruction of forest, you increase air pollution, everyone suffers, and Chesapeake Bay does too, because nitrogen pollution, about almost a third, is coming from atmospheric deposition, from exhaust, from power plants and cars. My last statistical thing is that in 2010, Marylanders drove over 56 billion vehicle miles, over 10,000 miles per person. That was a 40% increase since 1990. And state planning's projections is that we're going to increase that all the way from the 56 million to 84 million more miles per year by 2035. How can we live like that and allow this sprawl to continue while we debate whether the state should take a stronger role in land use?
Now, Leslie, I mean, it's this question. I mean, as somebody who's also grown up is believing in local control and people having control of their own lives, the question is, and the whole notion of participatory democracy resonates with me, but how do you – I mean, what is it you think that the people that you represent need and want? Should sprawl be controlled? Should it be stopped? Are there other ways to address this other than the ways that we see it happening?
Well, I think there's always things you can consider. Certainly, I think it would be pretty easy for everybody to agree that uncontrolled sprawl is bad. I just take that as a given. You don't want uncontrolled sprawl. There has been times in the past where, frankly, planning, long-term land planning in Maryland has not been a priority, either at the state or the local levels. But in the last few decades, and particularly since the advent of smart growth, planning is now one of the most critical issues that local governments deal with. I would say that you to address this moving forward, one of the things that I don't think anybody's mentioned yet and I view as one of the biggest failings of smart growth policy is that you have to get citizen buy-in. And whether it's to participate and vote or whether it's to achieve what you want to do through growth policies, you have to get individual people to be willing to change your behaviors. I think everybody can agree sprawl is bad. I think most citizens would say yes. It gets much harder to get people to agree on the details of how they're going to have to alter their personal preferences with respect to where and how they want to live.
Which, I mean, do you think that developers and county council people and executives have too cozy relationship, that's part of the problem?
I think as a general level, no. I would agree with Secretary Hall that overall I think Maryland, the comprehensive plans that are put into place and generally followed are good plans. That, yes, every now and again you'll get a particular instance where you do get something that goes beyond what it should.
Then how do you get – Valerie and I drove not long ago to visit a friend in St. Mary's County, and we come off of 97 – from Baltimore 97 is this sheer development all the way down the highway. You get off 301. You go down 301 through Anne Arundel County, Prince George's County, down towards St. Mary's. It's nothing but a one giant mall from one end to the other, or developments with gigantic houses from one end to the other. So how did that happen? And if that's not sprawl, I mean, when I was a kid and we drove through there with my father and mother to go places, was open. I mean, there were farms and there were some houses and some communities and little towns, and we have this gigantic state now in terms of population that's changed. But how did that happen?
The answer is because of the poor land use decisions by county and municipal governments. That's the bottom line. You know what's sad? What you just saw is continuing. There's nothing to stop it. It's continuing. The trend is actually that there folks are developing more acreage per capita, not less. Smart growth, Plan Maryland, Rich can, and his predecessor can trot out all of these mostly voluntary things that the folks have to do at the local level. When I say voluntary, they have to follow some broad guidelines, but they can snake out of this and frequently do. And if you were to say, if Leslie were to say for the Maryland Association of Counties or a county official would say, well, that was in the past. But it isn't in the past. The trends are still stifled a little bit by the economic slowdown, what Rich mentioned at the start of the show, that we're developing more land per capita. People are driving further to get to jobs. They're leaving urban areas like Baltimore City and many other municipalities. And the projections are, which is absolutely frightening for the fiscal sanity of this state, that by 2030 – because of 1 million more people driving so much, we're going to need to build 12,349 miles more of new roads. That's state planning data. I want you to think about that. 12,340. That's going back and forth to California four times in roads in this state that already has varicose veins with so many highways around it.
Let me read this. I'm going to come back to Rich here to ask this question. Somebody wrote in here, and remain anonymous, but I want to read it. It said, talking about transforming RC2 land to RC4-5, which is to changing the zoning so you can build
Baltimore
houses
County.
on farm. Oh, this is Baltimore County again. So, also takes income producing and transforms it into residential land that will use more government services. As various studies show, agricultural acreage costs much less to the county taxpayer at 37 cents. Of cost compared to $1.19 of cost of each dollar of revenue, a ratio of 37 cents spent for $1 generated compared to residential land, $1.19 spent to $1 generated. In Maryland, despite the much lower tax base and revenues for agricultural land, it remains economically beneficial to keep agricultural land, spending 91 cents for every dollar operated generated in agricultural tax revenue compared to $1.11 spent by the county for every dollar generated by residential developments. Well, that's the logic, but that doesn't seem to come to the fore because all we see is property tax dollars coming through the door.
Well, you know, the whole fiscal impact of developments or not developing is something that's brought up a lot at the state and local level when it comes to development decisions. Sometimes maybe not as much people like. They don't always drive those development decisions. And that some of the figures you cited, your caller cited on the cost of services to agricultural land are generally correct. We've seen those types of numbers before. In other words, when you have a piece of agricultural land, it costs a lot less in public dollars to service it than it does if you convert it to residential development. And, of course, that sometimes depends on what kind of residential development you're talking about. But so we do feel that keeping land in agriculture is very important for agribusiness and just the fiscal health of the state. And we work to do that through our state agriculture preservation programs and with local governments to protect rural areas for that use.
So what was said earlier and was said in the article was alluding to the Plan Maryland, like smart growth, really has no teeth. I mean, the governor was lamenting that he couldn't get the septic bill passed the way he wanted to, so, which might have had some teeth that he wanted to have at any rate, but that it has no teeth, that you can say this is what we think you should do, but you really can't tell anybody what to do. And some people would argue you shouldn't be able to tell anybody what to do, right? So.
Well, I think I'm glad you brought that up because Plan Maryland's not meant to have teeth. Plan Maryland is a policy document. It's a plan. And I know that might not get people excited sometimes, but I think it's a very needed part of the state's overall planning apparatus, planning policy program, if you will. On the septic bill, that bill that just passed, I think will go a long way to limit sprawl development and protect our local streams, rivers in the bay. The bill did change throughout the session, as just about all bills do. We had to work with people to get the bill passed, and you know it's part of the process. And yes, the state does not have the final say on where these key, simply put, teeters are, areas, exactly how the bill's implemented. So the state does not have the veto power over the local governments on how that's done. Which is different than the way it was introduced. However, there are very clear standards in the bill for how it's to be implemented, and I think the local governments will follow that law well in most cases, and I think over time that bill will go a long way, like I said, to limit some of the most damaging type of growth we have seen in this state, which is large lot development on ag and forest land on septic systems. So I think when you look at the weakest link in the state's overall smart growth programs, and I think the governor's bill on septic systems will go a long way to help strengthen that weakest link.
Okay. Leslie and then we'll go to Jerry.
I find myself in the usual situation here of where I'm going to have to agree with Secretary Hall yet again. Sometimes we're on the opposite sides of the matter, but the septic bill definitely will have teeth as counties and the county planners are starting to wrestle with how to implement this. There's no question that this will serve as a significant curb for sprawl in most areas. Obviously, it will not have as much of an impact in urban areas that are already built out, but in your rural areas, you will see an impact. But the septics bill is not the only bill that's out there, and smart growth certainly has not been static in Maryland, and it has had its flaws and it has its ongoing issues. But since 2006, the state has passed a lot of good legislation from a smart growth perspective. You have new water and resource municipal comprehensive plan elements from 2006. New stormwater requirements from 2007 and 2010, new requirements for your critical areas, which are your areas adjacent to the Chesapeake Bay and your Atlantic Ocean waterways in 2008, new planning requirements across the board as part of a smart, green, and growing bill package in 2009, the septics bill in 2012, and you also have the federally mandated Chesapeake Bay total maximum daily load, which forces the state and the counties to limit nutrient and sediment discharges into the bay.
Almost everything Leslie pointed out, the Maryland Association counties vigorously opposed the initial iterations. There's still many counties that have defied the EPA's pollution diet, including, for instance, Frederick County, Carroll County. A number of them have submitted almost non-plans to comply where the state has to backstop it. I would say also that the septics bill started out in 2011 with a bill that really did something. That's why it didn't go anywhere. MACO vigorously opposed it, where you could not build a new subdivision of five or more units once septic systems with various very tight restrictions. There's no reason that we should still be doing that. The bill that passed was emaciated to get it passed. While the bill was being handled on the floor, the plug was pulled out when a legislator took all the MACO regulations, and I'll name them if you want, a senator, and introduced those. He was another committee chairman with the consent of the president of the Senate, and then the governor renegotiated away what the bill that came out of committee, a lot of the stronger provisions. So now it's really up to the local governments with very little sway from state planning if they don't really comply with the weakened four-tiered system. So the original bill really would have done something in 2011. The reiteration of it would have done a little bit. And when it got out, it's really a question of whether the counties are going to implement. I was on another radio show a couple years ago, and I was struck on the air when Tom Horton, the famous author on the Bay and writer and thinker on the Bay, a native Eastern Shoreman, just blurted out on the show when we were talking about the Chesapeake Bay that the biggest enemy of the Bay is MACO. And, you know, he's not far from wrong. I would add the Maryland Farm Bureau as well, because what I've learned over 40 years of environmental advocacy, there's no more virulently anti-environmental group than organized agriculture. I don't mean individual farmers, but at the national level, they're suing to block the pollution diet in federal district court. They take a lot of money, and they also contribute the most pollution to the Chesapeake. But the only source that had been increasing until a year ago was from developed land, the pollution source of the Bay. It's the only major pollution source that's increasing because of the poor stormwater management systems that the counties and municipalities authorize and their poor planning. So I don't think you can sit here and tout all these laws when MACO fights almost every single one of these till they're weakened to a very minimum common denominator where the Farm Bureau, the developers, the real estate industry winks and says, hey, we can live with this. We'll yell and scream, but we can get by. Same with the septics bill.
Let me go back to the phones. Let's 410-319-8888. Celeste, you're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi, Celeste. Welcome.
Oh, I'm tired of hearing our representatives tell us that they're helping us. I have two things. Have the developers redevelop existing neighborhoods. They don't need to go outside and beat up this land. We need to come back to the city and redevelop the neighborhoods and contribute to the schools. And also, our representatives, I don't think they know what their constituents want. What they need to do is have meetings with their districts so we can know what they look like and what they represent, and they can know what we want.
And thank you, Celeste. Appreciate you being part of the show and giving your comments on the air. Rich, you were about to say something a minute ago, were you?
I was just two things. On Celeste's point, I agree with her. And I saw I set that up a little bit earlier, you know, talking about redeveloping the city or our older communities across the state, whether it's Baltimore City, whether it's downtown Cumberland, parts of Salisbury, Cambridge, parts of Prince George's County, you name it. One of the things I did want to loop back a little bit with what Jerry was saying about the septic bill. Yes, the bill did change from the way the governor introduced it, but the main part that did change was state approval of these four tiers, how you grow in septics and that type of thing. But if I just may—
We're almost out of time.
I think it's important that the core stayed in the bill, and as long as the counties follow the state law, I think we still have a very strong bill.
Gentlemen, we'll come back to this because I appreciate you all taking your time. This last email I'll just show you, share with you a minute, from George wrote in, I feel that the ever-growing population is the driving source behind a lot of the problems worldwide, including urban sprawl. It topped $7 billion last year, estimated to be $8 billion by 2027. If they can, most people don't voluntarily live in substandard conditions. They want nice things, nice homes, unless prevailing attitudes in our celebrity wish from society or human nature itself can be changed. Stopping development will meet considerable resistance. He's upset with global warming zealots because he wants them to understand that that growing population is causing a lot of this stuff. But he closes with, my feeling is that the fundamental truth is confronted and dealt with. All the other measures will have minimal long-term effect. And with the story, I remember as a kid, I rode a lot of buses. Ad showed a huge octopus plunked in a city with his tentacles curled over buildings and streets with his admonition, stop urban sprawl. This was around 1960, and you can clearly see what good it did. So that was the last comment from one of our listeners. I want to thank our three guests, Richard Hall, Maryland Secretary of Planning, Leslie Knapp, Associate Director of MACO, the Maryland Association of Counties, former State Senator Jerry Weingrad, now University of Maryland School of Public Policy professor. Good to have you all with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Folks, don't go away. We'll be right back. Switch our gears and look at the immigration controversy issue in front of the Supreme Court and where that might go.